So today, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Combat Fuel podcast. We are joined today by a long-standing friend of the brand, Afghanistan, Iraq veteran, Mr. Rick Webb, who hasn't actually lost his leg. It's all fake. Didn't get blown up. He made me say that. Rick, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
For your service. Thank you for coming on, being a part of this.
Pleasure, mate. Pleasure.
Who are you?
I'm Rick. I'm the dude that apparently blagged my injuries. None of this really happened. And I did it all for money and fame, apparently.
We'll touch on that later.
Yeah.
We'll touch on that later.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a good introduction as to where it is. And you know, I've known Rick, I've known you for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's wild. It's still wild to hear these things from the start. But let's rewind this whole thing. Like, where did your life start? I imagine from your mum, you weren't a test tube baby, were you?
Well, I don't know the size of my head might suggest otherwise.
It's very, very small.
Yeah, true story. Yeah, size 54 berry.
Tiny.
But no, yeah, so where childhood was, you know, I'm 38, so born in 87. So I find that we probably had the better end of childhood, if you will. We didn't have the pressures that kids have today with social media and all the rest of it, but you know, relatively normal, classic squaddy story, broken family. You join the army as a kid, you know, and then you find your family and you find kind of that sort of thing where dad thinned out when I was six. I joined my mum signed me in when I was 17 and then haven't really looked back from there.
Nice. Well, where did you grow up? Where was home for you growing up with your mum?
I was Andover. So literally around the corner for me, really. Joined the army to try and like, get away and, you know, go see the world. And then at the time, my unit were in Germany. But then by the time I got through training and all the rest of it, they were back in Tidworth. So I went 10 miles down the road.
Oh, love it. Close to home, though.
Yeah.
So what age were you when you joined the military?
I was 17.
17, so,
yeah.
So mum's permission to join because pre-18, wasn't it? What was your call, though, to join? Was it because of that broken family looking for something? A part of it, did you have a military background within your family at all?
No. So my granddad was army. However, I never met him though. He died before I was born. So the army wasn't really on my radar outside of obviously being Andover's like a military town, isn't it?
Yes.
Really? Overspill of London and whatever. So family from London, but I only know Andover. I had a full-time job at the time as well. It was relatively sensible. You know, I was a production engineer for a mobility firm. But growing up, I had a good friend of mine. He was going through training. He had finished his phase one. He was going through phase two, and his dad, kind of like my dad in a way,
yeah.
He was military through and through. And then one day, Aaron, his name is, come pick me up from my job, and he just said like, "You ever thought about joining the army?" And I went, "Not really." He went, "Do you fancy it?" And I said, "Yeah, all right. Why not?"
Nice. Why not?
So
let's give it a go.
When literally the first I'd ever thought about it was on the way to Salisbury Careers Office.
Yeah. And what year was this that you were
this was,
looking to join?
This would have been 04 now.
So 04. So you know that the atrocities of 9/11 have happened.
Yeah.
Is that a motivating factor for you at all? Or was it very much like, I'm looking at the army, it's a job, it might be something for me to do?
Honestly, yeah, I didn't really know. So I was very aware of what was going on in the world at the time. Obviously, we're 3 years into Afghan at that point, and then what are we a 1 year then into Iraq, aren't we? So it's very evident what's going on. But being so young, at the time I was 16, nearly 17, very naive, didn't really think about what the bigger picture looked like.
Yeah.
It was only then when I went down to the careers office, the recruiting sergeant was KRH, which turned out to be my regiment, and kind of said, "You need to join this regiment, you need to do this, you need to do that. This is where you're going to thrive." And obviously, you know what it's like when you walk through those doors, the first person you come to, you think, "You're a legend, I need to be you." Because you don't know any different, do you? So that's exactly what I did. And then once I started going through training, I kind of thought, "Oh, wow, this is what this is about, is it? I now feel like I fit." So before I went, just rewind slightly, a lot of my closer friends and family members are like, "You ain't going to make that." And that was a big driving factor for me, is just to say, even if I don't want to do this now, I'm going to, just to prove you wrong.
So a little bit of like disbelief from them, I'm going to join the army, I'm going to do this. And you had that almost like, of course you will. Mm, unless Could that maybe have been like your not a call to serve, but your reason to make sure you enjoyed training? Because training isn't easy.
Yeah.
Whatever cat badge you go to, be it from infantry, powers, marines, or even RSC, you still have to do training, you know, and if you pull the average person off the street, they probably can't do it.
Yeah.
So that was a big motivating factor for you to get through was that disbelief others held in you.
Yeah. So if, like you say there, you have to dig deep down, you have to go into a dark place in your mind. And that dark place for me was that failure. I can't fail this. I cannot fail this. And very, very quickly, it became apparent to me that this is where I was supposed to be. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed the grind, you know, being thrashed. I wanted to, at the time, I was like, I want to come back here and I want to instruct and I want to do that. You know, and obviously, again, you're naive. You don't know why these guys and girls are down there doing what they're doing for many reasons, isn't it? But very quickly, literally probably 2 or 3 weeks in, I'm like, right, this is what I'm supposed to do for the rest of my life. This is me. So then it became, how can I get better at this? How can I improve? How can I ensure that I don't fail? And kind of that dictated how I went about my military career, in that I needed to be the best I could be. I needed to succeed, or I wanted to succeed. And I think probably a driving factor was people not believing in me in the first place. And I really wanted to prove them wrong.
Nice.
And
nice.
I just so happened to...
Was there a highlight of training that you're like, that's a standout moment of there, knowing that you're going to get passed out? Was it your pass off or anything that happened during training for you?
I haven't really thought about it until you say, but probably on the pass out parade. So there's only me and one other KRH guy. So crimson trousers, or pink as a lot of people call them, but it's not pink, it's crimson, right? It's there was only me and one other. So we stood out from the rest anyway. Brownberry, bloody pink trousers. So that point there, when you do have the family come down and it's kind of like, you know, I've made it. This is now where it starts. It just rocketed from there.
Nice. Nice. So pretty straightforward for training. No,
pretty much.
No adversity, no big hidden dramas that happened in there.
Well, I suppose you probably for me, or for anybody in that situation, the first 9 weeks of training, I was light dragoons, cat badge. So when you first go, for those that don't know, when you get there, you have an idea of what regiment you want to join, or what you think you're going to go and join. And then you get in, at the time, maybe different now, but it's one long line, and you go into a room, they show you a map, and on the map, there's cat badges across where they're based, right? And they say to you, pick a cat badge. And like, well, that's the one I want right there. No, there's no room in that. Pick another one. And I was like, what do you mean there's no room in that? That's what I'm joining. He said, no, you can't. So I chose light dragoons, not having a clue what it was. I just remember that one. So then the first 9 weeks of my training, I was like trying to find a way of getting into KRH. And to go back to my friend Aaron, his dad was KRH. Then he transferred to the Army Air Corps as an Apache pilot, and just alley as balls, and was teaching Americans how to fly this thing. So essentially, I phoned him and said, this is what's happened. Is there anything you can do? And it, essentially, 9 weeks later, he had managed to make the phone calls and got me into KRH. So I remember being marched into the squad leader's office, and he said to me, I don't know who your friends are, but they've got some pulling power, and like frisbeed this berry at me and then said, now get out of my office. So the last 3 weeks of training, I was then KRH. So I had to quickly then change. I was like cat badge, number twos, barrett dress, all that. So ready for the pass out parade.
And so I suppose those friends that helped get you to KRH is what set up the rest of your career in the military, didn't they?
So. Yeah. So without him and without them, I would never have gone to where I was. And, you know, I owe them an enormous debt for kind of pulling the strings for me. Because, again, I was prepared to go to light dragoons and do that, but I never once doubted that I would end up KRH. So I don't really know what life would have looked like if I hadn't have gone KRH, but I was so convinced it was going to, I didn't even think too much about it. I was like, just, it's going to happen. And just like kind of willed it into place.
Awesome stuff, man. Awesome stuff. So we mentioned then about Germany's where you were going. You went straight out to Germany 2000.
No, so by the time I'd actually.
By the time you passed training, it was somewhere else.
They were
else.
Back in Tidworth. Yeah. So I want to say they came back in 2005. So that's when I ended up going to training. So it was very, it was either just as I was going into training or just before. But when I first looked at going, they were in Germany, or you know, potentially coming back. But I lived in Germany on and off when I was a kid, not because my dad was military. He was a bricklayer and went over to Germany in the early 90s to try and find some work and just never came home. So that's, I was back and forth to Germany. So I knew Germany and I loved it. So that's kind of another driving factor as to why to go to that regiment. But they just happened to come out of Tidworth in the
end. We're at battalion now, 2005, as a young, trained, eager, fighting fit soldier.
Yeah.
What happened? How was battalion life as soon as you got there?
So the first day I got to the regiment, I was walking across the parade square and I got screamed at by this dude. I didn't know who he was at the time. And he shouted, "Webb." And I was like, oh, shit, what have I done here? And, you know, day one, I'm in a lot of trouble here. Anyway, Captain Ford, his name was, and he was the manager of the football team, regiment football team. He said, "I hear you can play football." I said, "Yes, sir." And he's like, "Right, my office tomorrow morning." So then kind of, it was great for me because I'm straight into the football and, you know, trying to make a name for myself there. But equally, I'm literally brand new and I'm getting out of shit jobs and whatever else because I'm now playing football. So kind of, it went against me a little bit at the same time. But yeah, I loved it. It was class. You know, when I first got there, the regiment was still out in Canada. So it was kind of, it was quite quiet when I got back. But very quickly then, everyone came back home. We got put into the squadrons we were going to go into and whatever else. So for anybody that doesn't know as well, KRH is a challenger regiment, challenger tank, and I never once touched it. Outside of training, I got straight into what at the time was called the intermediate armor, so CVRT, very much kind of like recce vehicles. And that was me the whole time. It was reconnaissance vehicles or like a warrior or dismounted roles. I never actually did tank life, if you will. I've never once been on it and I wouldn't change it for a thing. Joined a tank regiment, couldn't stand them.
Love it. That's
couldn't
brilliant.
Stand things, yeah.
Once during the QRH to not play with tanks.
Correct.
That's a tank regiment. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's some infantry logic there. And as you know, I was infantry as well, so it's fine to say that. Iraq happened first to you, didn't it?
Yes.
How long was this until you deployed on
Telic 10 I did. So it was, I want to say it was like 18 months before then. So from joining the army to then deploying, I think it was about 18 months, something like that. So quite quick. But we'd done a full OPTAC package, pre-deployment training for Afghanistan on CVRT. So literally did the whole thing. And we were like 2 weeks away from deploying. I remember being up the garrison theatre and getting our briefs ready to go. Then we got pulled in for this emergency meeting. And I remember the squadron leader said, "Right, lads, everything you've learned over the last, what's it, 6 months or so, is it a pre-op thing? Forget, we're not going to Afghan anymore. We're going to Iraq." We're like, what? So we had like 3 or 4 weeks to shove this entire pre-deployment training package in for Iraq into what we, you know, the timescale to then disappear and go to Iraq. On CVRT though. So it was a pretty wild time in that we just did these back-to-back pre-deployment training packages. And then thinking we're going to Afghanistan, get switched last minute, Iraq. And then my first 3 months of that tour, I was in the desert then, like desert rat stuff, in OPs, just, you know, wasn't necessarily kinetic in the like downtown Basra. But you had a lot of IDF and stuff, but it was just, it happened so fast from what we were doing for Afghanistan to then all of a sudden I'm living in a hole in the desert and I weigh like 8 stone because it's just brutal. It was pretty wild, but yeah, that all happened very, very quickly. But I think I wanted it that way. I wanted it to be thick and fast.
Awesome. So overall, minus a lot of IDF coming in, it was a somewhat uneventful tour, would it be fair to say?
No, we had casualties and stuff like that, but it wasn't so like downtown Basra was way more kinetic in that it was IEDs mainly. We had a lot of small arms as well, but it was predominantly IEDs. Like the rifles lost like 9 blokes in 1 week. And we're all in that sort of scenario together, especially where you're living in Basra. It's every day, sometimes 50 times a day, you're getting Chinese rockets come in, you're getting mortars. It was relentless. And, you know, you've got to try and live your life. You're sleeping in a Kevlar coffin. You know, that was normal. So we didn't necessarily lose anybody. There was a few casualties from the tour, from sort of RTAs, a couple of IEDs and stuff. But in comparison to Afghanistan was a different type of kinetic, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Very different war fighting.
Yeah. You couldn't really see what you were fighting most of the time.
I think a lot of the, minus the invasion of Iraq, that obviously a few guys done, very different to the war fighting that was done on Herrick in Afghanistan,
wasn't it?
Will obviously, we'll touch on, and evidently some things that happened there.
Yeah.
Was there a defining moment of that tour of when you're like, this really is, I don't know what I signed up to do? Anything that was like really stand out for you during that Telic 10?
I mean, I loved it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, being out in OPs on the Iranian border, you know, giving information over to what we would consider to be legends and sort of rock stars in the SF community.
Yes.
Like, you know what I mean? I want to be that guy. So that was for me like, this is pretty cool. And I was 19 at the time. So wet behind the ears, not really understanding the bigger picture. But it was, I think I can remember sitting in this OP with my binos, looking at the border, watching stuff come across, handing over information. I just, this like, this is pretty wild. But so my best friend at the time is Civvy guy. I remember I got I got a mobile phone off of a local in what the Camp Charlie. And I was able to communicate messages and stuff like that. I remember he phoned me when I was back at the COB in Basra, asking me what I'm up to. And I was like, just cleaning my weapon in Iraq, mate. Why? What are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm in Magaluf having a party. And I'm thinking, and it's when I was in that hole and in the desert, I was thinking, he's probably, I don't know, balls deep doing some crazy shit right now in Magaluf. And I'm holding a foil bag for my mate to take a shit in. Do you know what I mean? Pissing in a bottle because we can't be found. We can't be seen where we are. So different, but that's what I didn't want to be anywhere else. That's where I wanted to be. A few things got in my way with Iraq, where it was so relentless in the desert. Like, blokes were cooking themselves. It was getting up to 90 degrees in the cabs. You know, it was 70 degrees in the heat, and you've got to try and live. You know, so a couple of times my kidneys just like shut down, and I was in hospital with like not heat exhaustion, but quite literally cooking from the inside out. And a few guys even to this day still have life-changing injuries from having been quite literally boiled.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? So that kind of hampered my progress for that tour, just that I wanted to be doing more and I had to be protected a little bit. I didn't really understand so much at the time. I do now. Certainly from a command standpoint, I understand why certain choices were made where I didn't necessarily go on that particular op, or I had a week out where I was kind of helping back at the COB rather than going forward and stuff. So at the time, I was pissed off about it. But equally, I understand that I probably would have been a liability for those particular ops, just in how I'd only been out of hospital for like a day, 2 days or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't change a thing. Not at all.
Awesome. So that's Telic 10 completed.
Yeah.
Luckily, the whole battalion made it back alive, which is awesome.
Yeah.
We're back into Tidworth camp now with QRH.
KRH.
Shut up, aren't
they? Yeah. It's all right. Easy mistake you make, mate. We're grunts.
They're the same thing, aren't they?
Well, yeah.
So we're back in camp.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of time between Telic 10 and Herrick that you deployed on.
Yeah, yeah.
You've cut about, done some bits. You've been promoted twice during these times.
Yeah.
A couple of times to Lance Corporal.
Yep.
You want to talk about those promotion courses at all? I imagine they're quite easy compared to the infantry.
Yeah. So we can go and do like a juniors, seniors, all that stuff is still really available to us. So I think that's the beauty of the armored corps, is that you have access to every part of what the army has to offer. So you can go off and do these courses, but our kind of, if you want to call them in-house or our version to the junior command course, it's all infantry based. And then the latter stages for your command aspect goes from the infantry stuff that we know to then commanding in various vehicles. So depending on what cabad you are, depending on what your main vehicle is or what you're using. So I was doing, obviously, CVRT, and then that was the only other time I touched a Challenger, and I fired one round downrange, and I was like, that was pretty fucking bonk. Can I swear, by the way?
You can do whatever you want.
That was
not the worst thing we're going to get cancelled for, is it?
No. So I was like, that's shit. I'm not interested in that. So I'm sure we do like two stages to it, since the juniors and seniors, but JCC 1, JCC 2. I'd already promoted when I went down to this course. So I had to hand in my rank slide, and you hand in your rank slide, you hand in your berry, and then you have to earn that back. So you pass the course, you get given your rank slide if you do have one, and then your berry. Otherwise, I'm sure, if I remember rightly, for the first like 4 weeks, you're walking around in webbing in a helmet. Do you know what I mean? Just to belittle you a little bit. And you kind of go back to day one, week one, don't you? I'm sure you know. But that, again, is when it sparked something in me. Like, this is what I want to be doing. I want to be on my feet. I want to have best of both worlds, where I'm in the recce type vehicles or the smaller vehicles, and have the opportunity to do both. I can fire 30 mil. I can fire a chain gun. I'm on my feet now, and I've got my rifle. It's kind of ticked all the boxes for me. And that then led into what I did for my tour in Afghanistan.
So it's when we get in there to command men.
Yeah, that's what
to
I
war
to do.
It's a very, very elitist group that you got to be a part of.
I don't think there's anywhere you can go from there in terms of job satisfaction.
No. And that's a job satisfaction.
Do you know what I mean?
You know, we all signed up to do it. And at the end of the day, it is a job, but it's not a job, is it? It's not a real job. It's a lifestyle, you know? And the opportunity to present itself, when I joined, there was a lot of people that this is what they'd lived for. You know, there were sergeants that had been in for years, and this is towards before mine, that were like, our whole careers have built up to this.
Funny you say that, because that can build resentment in people too. So I promoted quite early, twice. If you suck the right people off, you get it. Do you know what I mean? But no, so I picked up, I think I've been in regimental duty for 18 months before I picked up Lance Jack, which is quite quick. And then from there, I was a 5-year screw. So I'd gone quite fast. And then with the Armour Corps, you have to do 8 years at regimental duty before you can become a senior. So the plan for me, I was at my 8-year point then after the second tour. So the plan would have been straight down to then your final commander's course, and then you can pick up senior rank. So I was already penciled in to pick up sergeant at my 8-year point. I just didn't fucking look where I was going and ended up like this. So I didn't pick up. But to be a 5-year screw and then be in charge of your own multiple, at times the platoon, in the shit, doing what some of these blokes before us 20 years deep hadn't done, that built a lot of resentment, because they were now in a position of rank where they couldn't go and do what we were doing. So sometimes I had more experience than somebody that's been in 2-3 times longer than me, which didn't always sit well. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Which now, if I look back, a lot of these blokes were in places of power where they could dictate what your career looked like. And as such, a lot of blokes got shit on. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely unfortunate.
The way of the world.
But then we just have to take those things in our stride, don't we?
It happens in every job, mate. Yeah. It's just on a much bigger scale for us, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately. So what is the year and what Herrick are you on?
So it is 2012. And it is Herrick 16.
Yeah.
Summer tour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. Same tour as us, but different, weren't we?
Yes, yeah.
And you're the reason we couldn't use our sat phones to call back when it happened.
But the
tour.
Yeah, yeah.
How was the tour overall?
Fucking loved it, man. It's
warm.
Yeah, warm. You can run the risk of either sounding like a lunatic or selfish, or a little bit of both, but I would go back in a heartbeat. And my wife knows that. She'll listen to this and she won't be surprised to hear me say that. And it's not because I want to get away from her and the kids and life in general. It's just everything makes sense when you're there. And it's so simple. Just don't fucking die. And don't do something stupid. Like, it's, I remember coming back and being stood in Tesco. And I'd been asked to go get some cereal for the kids, right? And I stood there thinking and looking at this huge aisle of all this stuff. And I couldn't figure it out. Like, something as simple as go get the cereal, but there was so much there. I couldn't get my head around what I was needed to do. 24 hours prior, I was, you know, fucking four-finger pointing at someone. I was running. I was in the thick of it. And now something as simple as go and do that didn't make sense to me. Whereas I think that's why whenever we transition from the military to civilian life, we always struggle because you get told or you are telling someone exactly where to be, what to have on them, what to wear, you know, what is going to be happening, potentially what time it finishes. Everything to the minute is detailed for you, or you're detailing that for someone. So then all of a sudden, when all that's taken away and you just have this freedom, you go inside out. You don't know what to do with it.
And on that, how was the tour for you? Kinetic, a lot of deliberate ops, I think you were on.
Yeah, so it swings around about. Sometimes, I'm sure you know, like you'll go a long time with not a lot. You're doing a lot, but you're not necessarily getting the kinetic stuff coming back at you because they're just how they operated. Like, you know they're there. But then by this point, the restrictions have started to come in for what you can and can't do, and you have to go and poke the hornet's nest, and once they then contact you, you can then contact them. So it was very much mixed up and down like that, but it was predominantly IEDs that we were dealing with. But yeah, we were kind of like an ops model in a way. So although we had our own AO, we weren't very often in it. We were jumping on a Chinook. We were going to where was needed. Like, I remember getting to the FOB, and we were in Nyadullah at the time. It was kind of like our central hub, and we would go out for weeks at a time on various ops and what have you. I remember we got to Nyadullah day one, finding our feet, and then I got tasked to basically put a model together of 10 blokes, and we were just going to go on this 10-day op throughout Afghanistan. Like, starting at various points and then moving north along the way. So we were kind of here, there and everywhere. And it was this huge joint op with the Afghan army and the police. I'm sure the police were there too. And I remember at this point, I'd been in maybe 2 days, been in country 2 days, something like that. And we went on this strike op, this big group of compounds where, you know, there's someone naughty in there. Long story short, we need to go in and get this person and then fuck off. But it must be led by the Afghans at this point. It was very much joint ops, wasn't it? Must be led by them, or despite the fact that we're the lead vehicle. So at this point, I'm in a Mastiff. I'm the mobile commander. I'm the 2IC. My mobile commander, he's a captain. He's up in the... he's top cover. We get to this. We're on a track. And we get to this sort of end point where we can only go one way, but there's very clearly ground sign in front of us. And the driver said, like, oh, there's something out there. You need to figure this out because we've got this huge convoy behind us. We need to get in. We need to have the strike up in literally like 150 meters down to our left. And no sooner did I step out with my point man with the Valen, or the horn at the time, sorry, bang, contact. So to try and cut a long story short, we had to go out and clear this ground. But every time we stepped in front of the vehicle, so we would get contacted, couldn't really see where it was coming from. So first off was contact to the right, then it was contact to the left, and then just all hell broke loose. And I remember taking a knee at the back of the vehicle because I'm ducking down behind poppy season early in the tour. It's poppy season, right? And I'm ducking down, and I remember thinking, this is the Salisbury plane. This is insane. It's just everybody unleashed. You had 50 cal, and this group of compounds is just flat. Or being flattened. And I'm thinking, fucking hell, this happened quick. That escalated quick. And then all of a sudden, I hear this huge fucking bang next to my head. And I think, and I look like that at this guy, he's a Royal Welsh guy, Shipley, his name was, good lad. He looked at me and I looked at him as if to say, did you just fucking ND? What was that? And he looked like, no. And I went like that and I looked at the side of the vehicle and there's this huge hole at the side of the Mastiff. And then it clicks. There's a sharpshooter. So as it clicks, a second bang goes off, but this huge plume of dust comes up next to my left knee. And I'm like, oh, he's just bracketed. But he's gone, he's overcorrected. So as that happens, we then realize what's gone on. I jump up, we both run round the back of the wagon as the third round hits the wagon. And of course, if I hadn't moved, he had me then. Do you know what I mean? He'd missed left, he'd missed right, he'd overcorrected. Bracketing means that third round's going to hit me, right? So jumped in the back of the wagon, immediately sparked up a fag, like, welcome to Afghan. And yeah, and I was like, this is what I want to be doing. This is fucking mint. Let's go sort of thing. So that was the next 10 days of that op. Very much just here, there and everywhere, stopping at different PBs, stopping at different FOBs, checkpoints, whatever, and just kind of bolstering wherever needed bolstering. And that was really the entire tour. It was like that, but with a little bit of our own stuff thrown in the mix.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
And it is. You know, sitting there listening to it, you know, I've known you for what, the best part of 10 years.
Yeah.
Still hearing stories now, it still takes you back, reminiscing on, as you said, simpler times though, right?
Yeah.
Best times of our lives. Best times of our
lives.
It is, yeah.
And because it is just so simple, but it's insanely difficult when you think about it. But that's kind of what we are bred for, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I had no dramas with it. I loved it.
Brilliant, man. Let's take us forward then to the day that you became who you are now, the start of that. What was the day? How far were you into the tour?
So that was the 6th of June. So literally D-Day, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're just over halfway through. I want to say I flew out there end of March, beginning of April, quite relatively early. I'm pretty sure that was it. So someone may well correct me there. But yeah, we're halfway through. And we've been tasked to essentially clear a route because at the bottom of this route, there's some bad people that we need to go and pick up, whatever. But to rewind slightly, in the O group the night before, I had expressed my concern to suggest that this shouldn't be a tasking for me and my blokes. This should be a brimstone thing. So engineers, because of the nature of what we had to clear. And to quote the 2IC of the squadron at the time, we're going fucking bomb hunting. And I was like, nice one. That's on your fucking head now. That's on your head. So obviously I'm a buckshee screw. I've got no pulling power. I do as I'm told. So I expressed my concern. The boss, Captain Gillespie, he expressed his concern. And of course we get told, shut the fuck up, get in your box, go and do as you've been told. So you do. And literally, I don't know, 16 minutes into said tasking, fucking bang, right? So the nature of what it was, we would have never found it anyway. So I remember reading the Brimstone, or the engineer's report on their tasking after. And the nature of the IEDs was very little to no metal content whatsoever. So I don't know if you remember, so you had the Valen, which is literally a metal detector, isn't it? Or you had the Horn, and then you had a Horn 2. So the horns would detect anomalies in the ground, wouldn't they? So if you bury something, inevitably it has an air pocket around it. However, same as they were in Iraq, they're very crafty, and I have to give them their dues. They're fucking intelligent. They understood what the reading on the scale of the horn, I think it was like 1 to 10 or something, wasn't it? They know that anything underneath like a 2 or a 3, you're just going to sack off. Because if you stopped for everything, you'd never move. So that in our heads is a water ball or a big rock. And they knew that. So the way they buried these devices were to avoid detection. And it's exactly what they did. Because the one that we set off was in a safe lane that we had created. So that's either a fuck up from someone or them being real crafty, or potentially both. So that plays on my mind a lot because I was the one. So essentially my point man, Brownie, shout out Brownie, he had said, Rick, I think I might have something here. And I was like, let me look. And I made the command decision of, no, that's nothing. But that's what the book says, right? Gut feeling at the time, I don't think I thought too much about it. Kind of maybe a bit naive, maybe that feeling of invincibility because of the stuff we'd already seen and done at that point. I was like, I'm fucking untouchable. Maybe, I don't know. But hindsight's a wonderful thing, right? So if you look back at the footage, I'm sure that's the eighth time that one of us had stepped in that particular area before it then went off. So it really could have been anybody. It just happened to be me and Brownie that were there at the time. So essentially, we'd got to this track that we had to clear. We'd cleared left. We'd flicked right. And we were starting to move down. And kind of in the middle of this track was this, I always try and describe it as like a road hump. So it went up, then flattened out, and then went down the other side. And it turned out that there was 9 IEDs in that one area. And what the Taliban had done, literally just the day before, was buried all these devices in there for vehicles, because they assumed that we would go down there with vehicles because it was a bigger route and what was at the end of the tasking was quite punchy. So they had, on the slope, the upslope, the flat slope, and the downslope, it was 3-3-3. So you had 2, like, 5-kilo charges left and right, and then you had a big 20-kilo charge in the middle. And the idea was the wheel would go over the pressure plate, and then offset was the device to go off underneath the vehicle. If that didn't work, it would get the driver and the commander as they got out of the vehicle, or people coming to them. And obviously the fail-safe was if the first 3 didn't get it, the second 3 would, and so on and so on. Or the hope was that 120-kilo charge would daisy-chain the rest, which is the high chance it would happen, right? So we get to this slope. I say to Brownie, do your thing, mate. Just be careful. 30 seconds in, he's like, fucking confirm. Found one of these smaller devices, right, on the flat bit. So I was like, right, okay, now we need to start putting in the whole 4Cs thing. You know, you clear it, confirm, clear, corner control, don't you? And then you get the 10-liner coming over, thinking, right, now I need to paint a picture for the engineers to come in. Anything we can get now makes their job easier, which makes our job quicker. We can get the fuck out of it. Because I know, I've been in this position before, I think, fuck, I've got 9 hours set in now. Do you know what I mean? How can I avoid this? But safely. So essentially it was, get the camera. Rather than me trying to fucking eat crayons and draw a picture for him, just take pictures. Just literally take photos for him. So I was now stood in the safe lane with Brownie, and we're probably 10 feet away from the confirmed device. And I say to him, clearly mark that for them. Clearly mark where the safe lane is for them. And he said, oh, I think there's something at the bottom on the right over there, as in another bit of ground sign. I said, don't confirm it. Mark it and avoid for now, because they are going to come in and let them do their thing. They're the experts at this, right? But just make sure we mark it so they know it's there, so which we were about to do. So I say to him, go mark that. At this point, I had now checked in the safe lane again with the horn, and I had called, no, it's fine. As I turned right to go and take a picture of the device from a distance, Brownie turned left to go and mark and avoid the other ground sign. Bang, in the middle of us two. So at this point, we had triggered the pressure plate for the 20-kilo charge, right? Not the smaller ones. Fortunately for us, it was a partial debt because the HME was wet. The explosive was wet. So he went one way. I went the other. And I don't really remember if I was on my back, if I was still stood up. All I remember is kind of, like, I think maybe like on my knees, or I kind of looked up. And immediately I thought, who the fuck was that? I thought, I'm going to have to dish out a bollocking. Someone's like fucking thrown a grenade. All these crazy things went through my head, right? Are we being contacted? What's going on? I remember looking at the device that Brownie had just confirmed, thinking, fuck me, I'm close to that. And then all the shit clears. I look up and I see the guys, and they look like they're like 200 meters away from me. They're not. They're within the whole ECM thing. So they're like 20 meters away from us, I guess, 25 meters, whatever it is. And then I hear the noise. And it was like a newborn baby crying and a pig squealing. But that noise was Brownie. And I was like, now I know what it is. Click. I now I know what it is. And I can feel like my chest wants to be ripped out. I can feel that something's gone through me at this point, but I didn't really think too much of it. I looked up, saw the guys. I shouted, man down. And obviously, this is the classic bit of training where you're supposed to just stay, aren't you? Stay still. Don't fucking move, because you could potentially make things much worse. It's that risk reward, isn't it? The second I heard him screaming and I shouted man down, I was like, I'm not fucking standing here. So I got up and I ran to Brownie. I remember I pulled him over and he was kind of like half hanging off of this like slope I was talking about. It wasn't a wadi the other side, but there was some shit down there. I can't remember what it was, but like some farmer's shit or whatever. And I dragged him away from it and I rolled him on his back. And I can remember seeing like he was as white as what your shoes are. And I looked at what was his right side. And it looked like someone had taken a sledgehammer to his hand and his arm, and he was missing a load of like the map pocket stuff of his leg. And essentially, he had been holding his rifle kind of like this as he went to move. So he picked it up like this, went to move, so then he could organize his shit. But because of the way he was holding his rifle, it turned that into shrapnel, and that just along with the blast, it just ripped him apart. And I remember looking, thinking, I can put my hand through that, like through his hand sort of thing. And I was like, that's really not good. So I the first thing I did was got his med pack out, started fixing him up. I'm screaming for the medic because at this point I don't know if there's further injury. I don't know, right? So I do the right thing, shout for the medic. And this dude just freezes, which is fine. You know, I don't blame him for it. At the time, I was like, get a fucking grip. Move, as you do though, right? You do, of course you do. I don't blame him for that, not at all. So he wasn't coming. And now I'm very aware now that it's just me and Brownie here. I'm on my own. But no sooner did I think that, Finn, I love this dude. He come running up to me and grabbed me on the shoulder and was just screaming in my face like, are you okay? What the fuck's going on? I was like, will you calm the fuck down? Like, because he's panicking a bit, right? But he's trying to help, but he's panicking. I was like, I need to get a grip of this dude because he could potentially be the problem now. I know there's more out there because we've just fucking found one. So that secondary I've hit, that one that Brownie thinks is an IED, I now have to assume that is an IED. And I have to assume that there's more. And I have to assume that we're going to get contacted. Do you know what I mean? I have to assume worst case scenario. So I'm getting a grip of Finn whilst trying to treat Brownie. So I was like, I need to give him a job because if I don't give him something to do, he's going to fucking panic and start running around. So I say to him, give Brownie morphine. And he's like, I don't know how to do it. What do I do? I said, read the fucking instructions. It's right there. Just calm down. So he whips out this coffin and he starts reading the instructions of how to administer morphine, but at like 100 mile an hour and really loud. And I was like, dude, just calm the fuck down. It's all right. So he stabs him with the morphine. I write M 0913 on his cheek. And then I was like, right, we need to move him. We need to get him up. So at this point now, Lomax, the younger lad, he was 18 years old. He come up to us. He had horned his way to us very, very sensibly, which is exactly what he needed to do. So now we have a route that is deemed safe to get Brownie from where he is to the HLS that's already now been marked up in the background. So makeshift stretcher. I grab Brownie and this dude without kit on is fucking 120 kilos. He's massive. Like he's tall, he's built like a brick shit house. With his kit on, he's touching like 200 kg. I just fucking whip him up, shove him on this stretcher and start carrying him with the boys. I'm running to the HLS. This has all happened in like 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And it's only then one of the other boys, Neil, said, Webby, okay, you were on top of that. And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And then I wasn't. I remember I got to the HLS. This is all in seconds. Got to the HLS, dropped Brownie, and I just fucking collapsed. Like adrenaline had worn off at this point. And now I'm a casualty. I wasn't aware that I was. I just went straight into, I don't know, Falls Crew dad mode, if you will. I've got to protect the boys. So once I knew that that was okay, my kind of my body went like, you're on your ass, mate, maybe sit down. So I had kind of, I'd hit the deck and I was sort of very much in and out, not of consciousness, but just awareness more than anything. And I started thinking about my daughter at the time, thinking, fuck, what's going on? This could have been so much worse. What's next? And it all happened very quickly. And it was only after, very recently, that I had learned that I was the main concern as a casualty then, not Brownie, because of things like internal bleeding. My heart rate was, I don't know, really high or whatever. So they were more concerned, the Pedro team were more concerned about me when they got there than they were about Brownie, which to me made no sense. But from that point, I remember the Pedro, I remember laying on the ground, Matty Sumner had my dick in his hand, making sure that was all right. Finn had sparked me up a fag and I was smoking that. Because we'd already always said, like, boys, if I'm gonna go out, I want a cigarette in my mouth. I want to go out. I smoked like a chimney back then. So I remember being annoyed at Finn because he'd give me a Marlboro Light instead of a Lambert and Butler. Just random shit like that. Try and, you know, build the morale a bit. Because I know now that I want to get on this Pedro, there's a strong chance I don't come back. So yeah, I remember the Pedro coming in. And the first one, like, flies over over the top of you, clears the route. Second one lands, like, on top of you. And then you have these US Marines just screaming at you. I'm just do it. These guys are fucking legends, aren't they? Like the Pedro team and the Mert team, they're legends. And yeah, I remember being thrown onto the back of this helicopter and a US Marine screaming in my face, like, do you want pain relief? And I don't really remember what I said. I just remember, I think, falling asleep. So I would assume I got given pain relief. I can't really remember. And I'm sure actually Brownie had that drill in his fucking collarbone, whatever it is. Is it ketamine? Like, bang. So he's now out. And I didn't realize either, but apparently they had engine failure on the ground. So what they had to do was, like, this, I don't know, like an electromagnetic pulse or something. And basically what that did was completely fried the ECM for the boys. So now they're left on the ground, diffy two blokes, and fuck all ECM in a theater that is predominantly IEDs. So for those that don't know, ECM is the electronic countermeasure. So that stops like radio transmitted IEDs being detonated, right? It's using like mobile phones in Iraq was a big one, wasn't it? So now they're completely pissing in the wind and they've got to wait for someone from PB4 to come down, which was the rifles lot, to come down and essentially reload their ECM for them before they can carry on. But I didn't know any of this had happened. I just thought that we were in transit. I didn't really know, but from Boom to Bastion was, I think someone told me, I'm sure, was 42 minutes.
So, and just to touch on that as well, you didn't know at that point that you were a casualty or that this IED that had gone off had had anything to do with you. I mean,
no, I had no idea.
Evidently now you don't have your left leg.
Yeah.
But at this time you still had your leg, didn't you?
Correct, yeah. So I was very aware that I was in pain, right? I was very aware that something had happened. But I was also very aware that if I had told the absolute truth, they were going to send me back to England. And I would essentially miss out on the rest of the tour. Some might say selfishly, stupidly. For me, it was, in my head, if it 1% chance that I can finish this with my men and bring everybody back home, I was going to do that. And I knew that by telling the truth about how much pain I was in, that was going to be taken away from me. So I made the choice to not say too much. And I also made the choice to put the pressure on my boss, Captain Gillespie, to allow me to come back out. So I had to get signatures from him and the medic who was running the med center at Nidola, Andrew Turley, his name is, shout out Andy, absolute legend. He ensured that I was able to carry on being useful. Two or three times they tried to say, like, you've got to go back because something's clearly fucking not right here. But I said, come on, we're nearly at the end now. But I'll do light duties. Just fucking let me finish. Like, I'll run the ops. I'll do something. But of course, you know, you're light on the ground. I have experience. I'm commanding. So I was always in the thick of it, even in shit state. So essentially, I went back to Bastion, limped around for like a day. I was in shit state. Managed to get myself back to like the rear echelon lot, you know, where before you fly out to wherever you're going to in Bastion, you get given all your kit and shit, don't you? I can't remember what that place is called. But essentially, I went back there where my regiment was and I said, when can I get on a flight back to Nidilla? And everyone's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, you've just been spanked. You need to go back. I was like, I fucking don't. I've been cleared. And no one could quite believe the fact I've been cleared, and least of all me. But it's important to note at this point, in Bastion, I didn't have any scans, x-rays, nothing. I remember being taken off the helo onto the ambulance and then the ambulance into the, I think it was the theater room, because I remember all the nurses and stuff standing around you. And then obviously you got like bright lights and stuff. I remember that. So that I'm sure that was the theater room and I was on a spinal board. And I remember them going 1, 2, 3, lifting me off. And then I don't remember too much other than being in a bed, still covered in some blood, mud, dust, whatever else, saying like, where's Brownie? And he was in theatre. And then a very kind nurse said, like, can I get you anything? It was literally like, I need a brew and a fag. Like, all my stuff's gone. Like, my map pocket had gone too. So I always used to carry a fresh deck of 20 in my map pocket, gone. So she kindly wheeled me outside and I had a smoke and a brew. But yeah, like, it was at that point. You could argue there was some negligence there. I'm not ever going to say that because for all the brilliance that Camp Bastion has done and did for all of us, they don't need this fucking piss flap trying to get some money out of them. I'm not about that. But evidently there was some big things that were missed that made me end up the way I am. So to touch on your intro about being a blagger and that, because I finished the tour with a little bit of light duties in the middle to try and recover as much as I could, I finished the tour. So then when I came back, I was ordered then to go to the med center the following morning. From there, then I was ordered to go to Salisbury Hospital and see Colonel Dunn.
How long was this from when you came back from Afghanistan? Did you have to go like
the same day? So that afternoon, I had to go to the med center.
Yeah.
The following morning, they said, come back the following morning.
So you didn't even get your pothole leave.
No, this, yes. Yeah,
so straight down the med center.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not on leave at this point. I'm still in work. And essentially, there's no doubt about it. I did more damage by continuing, right? But what transpired next, I think people struggle to believe or understand. So from getting to the med center and they were like, you need to go and have more investigation, there's scans and whatever else, x-rays and that. So I went to Salisbury Hospital and they got a war injuries clinic there. And it was Colonel Dunn or Mr. Dunn. And he was like the go-to surgeon along with Miss Crick for war injuries, be it gunshots, IDs, whatever. And he said, like, how did you walk in here this morning? And I was like, just a bit of a limp, you know, whatever. I had a crutch at the time, I think. He said, no. Like, how? I said, what do you mean? He said, did anybody ever told you that you've got a broken hip? No. What are you? No, I haven't. I've just fucking walked. I've just done 2.5 months in Afghan carrying 78 kilos on my back. No, I don't. I said, you fucking have. So I then went to go and have like arthrograms and scans and yeah, confirmed my left hip. So essentially that slope I mentioned, the ID, I was stood on like the top of it here and Brownie at the bottom. It hit my left side and shoved my femur up. So my femur had gone up through my hip, broke my hip, and as it came back down, so it dragged my sciatic nerve into my hip. But a very similar thing had happened in my knee with my peroneal nerve, hence the reason I'm now above knee, but I'll come to that bit. So the sciatic was stuck in my hip, and the ball joint of my hip had a crack through it, along with, I forget what it's called, but like the bit that your ball sits in was this bit at the bottom here would kind of a little bit come away. So what would happen every now and then was the ball joint would slip in and out. But every time it was doing that, it was tugging more on my sciatic that was stuck in there. So the pain and numbness and stuff I was feeling was from the, one, the fracture in my hip, but two, more so the nerve damage I had done from the blast. So every now and then when I was on patrol or whatever, my leg would either give way or I couldn't use it properly. And yes, to look at it now, I probably was a liability. But at the time, I was like, I'm fucking doing this and nobody is going to stop me. And I did my job exactly how I needed to. I was able to run. I jumped. I carried people. I was fighting. I was doing what I needed to do. And it was that adrenaline that helped push me through, along with copious fucking drugs that we could get our hands on. So then from then on, it was real quick. Essentially, I was put on the biff in a way, told to use crutches, told to go into light duties, go on your leave. And then it was very thick and fast with appointments in Salisbury Hospital, Oswestry Hospital, where they had an orthopedic surgeon up there that took over the care for my hip. And it was then that I needed an operation to take the sciatic nerve out from the break in my hip. But the only way to do that was to go in through my left arse cheek. So I've got this big bacon slice scar on my left arse cheek from where they went in. And yeah, at that point, a large chunk of my sciatic was removed because it was fucked. They can't actually do anything for a broken hip other than just fucking leave it to heal. So it isn't great. But yeah, essentially permanent nerve damage now, you know, sciatic and peroneal nerve, plus then the break in the hip. And it escalated quite quickly where I don't know if it was after the first surgery or not, but my left leg essentially started to like die away. So with the nerve damage I had, it was really difficult to wear trousers. It was really difficult to be outside where the wind would hit my skin and stuff because it was so sensitive, like hypersensitive with the nerve damage. It felt like prickly heat, but like tenfold. And then I got drop foot. So my left foot, I couldn't lift it up. I had no plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. So I had to wear a fucking brace. And essentially rehab, another operation on my sciatic and another two operations on the peroneal nerve in my knee came to nothing that would to make any difference for me. And it was put to me by Miss Crick. Sorry, not Miss Crick, 2 weeks later. It was put to me by Colonel Phillip at Headley Court. For your quality of life, you probably need to consider amputation. And at that point I went, okay. You know, not because, as people say, you wanted the money. Are you fucking mental, for one? What's wrong with you?
Rather have my legs.
Yeah, rather have my fucking legs, mate. Because at this point, I was going back to work.
Yeah.
Nothing was going to stop me getting back to the regiment and carrying on.
And going to seniors.
Correct.
Yeah.
Nothing was going to stop me doing that. So in my head, if they said to me, my quality of life is going to be better and I'm going to be able to do more, I can be a fighting fit soldier again. Whip that fucker off. Do it. So yeah, they did, below knee initially. But I had quite a small residual limb below the knee. So wearing a socket and stuff like that was quite difficult. And I still was having issues with the nerves that they'd left in there as well. So the prosthetic I was wearing at the time, I had to have like, it was these metal braces come up the sides and I looked like Forrest Gump. But it was fucking shit. I had this old like Victorian corset thing on to try and hold it all together. It was crap. So that's when Miss Crick come in. She was like, who the fuck has done that to you? That's a mess. We've got to go through knee. Amputate through knee. And I was like, okay, you're the expert. Do it. If that's going to means I'm more mobile, I'm able to do more, the quality of life's better, there's less pain, there's no meds required, all this shit, go for it. So she did it. And it was great for about 6 months until it wasn't. And then I kept having the same issues with the nerves that was left in the bottom of my stump. Kept having issues with sockets. And then again, the same thing. She was like, this is the last straw. We probably should have just done this from the offset, but you have to cross every bridge because one of those other surgeries might have worked. But anyway, hindsight, you need to go above knee. So I was like, all right, fucking above it in knee it is then. So this is another third amputation surgery. Go above knee, halfway through my femur.
And it's the third surgery, but how many surgeries are we at
28.
Together now?
28. Oh. The four of those is on my hand, but yeah. My hand is unrelated from Afghan.
We'll touch on that in a bit.
That's a funny story.
Someone being a Hmong.
Completely.
We'll touch on that.
Absolutely Hmong, yeah. So 28 I'm on, yeah.
28 surgeries.
24 on Afghan-related injuries.
Yeah. And it's still fake. You didn't lose your leg from an IED blast.
Yeah, but apparently, yeah. So basically, people had started to talk about me as though I was this fucking shit house there to blag it, wanted the money, wanted the sympathy, wanted the attention.
And let's be perfectly honest, the money you get from losing a limb in the military in service of our country isn't a lot. You can't go and buy a four-bed detached house in the area we live in with the money you would have had. It's not, I'm going to be a millionaire and go and have all of this cool stuff, is it? It's not
far from it.
What people may think.
It could be, depending on what the injuries are. It could be depending on how many policies you have. You know, some lads I know got millions, but very different scenarios, obviously. Yes. So I think everybody assumes that's the standard.
And having people come at you in that way, directly or indirectly, was there a bit of an issue? Did that start, your mental health took a bit of a turn to the worst, didn't you? You know, a very proud commander of men to... You're faking your leg, so...
Oh, it broke me.
What? Oh, you just called up a surgeon, like, can you take my leg off? Or you did it with a Stanley knife in the block?
This is it, mate.
So, beggar's belief, really.
Honestly, it broke me because I know, and the important people know the truth, but that doesn't stop me worrying what other people are thinking and other people are saying. And to hear of people I thought I knew and were friends of mine saying these things, calling me a fucking faker, I'm a blagger. The MO, the RMO, one of the RMOs at the time, and I found this out for a good friend of mine that was working in the welfare for the regiment at the time, she had said, there's fuck all wrong with me. Wow. I'm blagging it. I'm like, this is coming from the RMO.
Wow.
And I was like, and I haven't seen that cunt since, and I'd love to. I'd fucking love to pull her a new one. But you know what? Fuck you. You know what I mean? If that's how you make yourself feel better about what you do, do you, sister.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, but yeah, it broke me, mate, because I felt now like a failure. I felt like a fraud. You know, it didn't get ripped off there and then. So I'm not deserving of the rehab. I'm not deserving of the compensation, you know. The marriage at the time was struggling, which was a bit of a catalyst to my downfall as well. But predominantly going from leading men, doing the best job in the world, to then nothing and not feeling worthy of any of it was a really difficult thing for me to try and navigate. At the same time as the army saying, you're now fucking useless to us. Off you pop. Don't worry though, we're going to give you a pension. So you're fine. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, what? I don't want to leave. Like, no, you have to. This, you don't have any other choice. And I'd heard these stories and seen these stories about other blokes being given us, like even amputees still serving one way or another. And I was like, I'll work in the fucking stores. I just want to be in rig. Don't take it away from me. I'm not done. I'm not finished. I've got so much I need to go and do. I had visions, like me and Finn, especially the guy I spoke about before, we were going to go and do selection. I know we all talk about it, right? I'm not saying I would have been SF. I'm saying I would have tried. You don't know. You don't know what comes off that. But I would have tried and I would have been a better person at the end of it, regardless of what that outcome was, just for the experience more than anything, right? So all of this now has been taken away from me double quick, as well as the people I look up to, respected, I thought respected me, are telling these fucking stories about me, telling it's fake, I'm a blagger. None of this really happened. You didn't even get blown up. You know what I mean? I'm like, were you on the fucking patrol? You know, were you there? And essentially, the, I don't know, thank you or the reward I got for what I thought was doing the honourable thing of going back out and finishing what we'd fucking started, I I got shit on from a great height as a result. And I was like, how can somebody that has put themselves so far out of the norm here, because I'm not saying I was a fucking super soldier, I'm not trying to say that, but I don't know how many other people would have done what I did to go back after that had happened. For one, dare I say, they may have been too frightened to go back, or they would have gone, oh, I'm in shit state, I can't do that, I don't want to do that. Whereas I was like, if you fucking send me home, I'm kick you, like, stand by sort of thing. So I've really fought my corner. The boss fought for me. The medic at the time fought for me. And I needed to get back to the blokes. And this is the bit that every time sticks with me, is I remember when I got back to Nidalee on the Chinook, and the blokes didn't know what was going on with me at this point. They're asking for updates, and they don't have it because no one's got the information. So they don't know I'm coming back. And I remember getting off the Chinook, and I went, Andy, the medic guy, he came and met me off the Chinook, grabbed hold of my kit, gave me a fucking hug. And he's like, dude, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, what are you doing? And I explained to him why. Please don't say anything to higher. Like, this needs to stay between us. Please just help me where you can. And he did. And he did help me. Said that the lads are down there sort of thing. So I remember I walked back into the tent. First person I saw was Finn. And he come running up to me, man. Just grabbed hold of me then. And I knew that was worth it. That's why I went back for that. And I fucking finished it. I did it. And the thank you I got at the end was, you're a fucking liar. Fuck you. Fuck you. Like, how dare you say that? Yeah. Like, and it broke me. It broke me big time, man. And that's when I just, when I was discharged from the military then, it was a fucking spiral, double fast.
Yeah. So, you know, which is amplified by a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And access to alcohol.
Alcohol.
And drugs.
Drugs. Gambling.
And
you
that.
You name it, yeah.
Marriage had, at this point,
yeah,
wasn't great.
No, so by the time I come round to being discharged, we had already split.
Yeah.
So it was, I want to say, like May 2016, the weird split. So I still had 2 years of rehab at this point. So I was back and forth to Headley Court. I was living at Headley Court because I didn't have anywhere else to go at that time. I managed to get a property to rent. I think maybe in like Way Hill or somewhere close to where my kids were, right? And I remember when I left and I walked out, I saw my boy was crying, my daughter was crying, and it was all my fault. She let me know it was all my fault. I was a burden. I was the reason that everything was falling apart. It was difficult, man. I'm not here to slag anybody off, but there was a lot of alcohol involved from that side too. And I just had enough of being a fucking shit shield. I was dealing with my own demons, and I couldn't do it there. I couldn't do that there.
You can't look after anybody else if you can't look after yourself.
Had to get out, yeah. I had to get out. But actually, what happened was the freedom that I had been given, because during the week I was at Headley Court, and outside of, so for those that don't know, Headley Court is literally full-time rehab. So you have a plan, you go off every day, your orders, you go to first parade, and then throughout the day then you get your lessons you go to, your sessions you go to, your rehab, whatever it is, whatever has been designed for your rehab specifically. And at the end of that day, you go get scran, and then the time's your own. So I was boozing, I was gambling. Drugs wasn't in there then at this point. But also, I had gone on to self-destruct, where I thought it'd be a great idea to start sleeping with one of my therapists. she took massive advantage of the fact that I had money, that she knew the buttons that needed to be pressed to make me act a particular way and get her particular things. Blinded by it at the time, you don't really realize what's going on, do you? But, you know, again, hindsight's a fucking wonderful thing, but I thought it was, because at this point I was single at this point, and I was like, and you know, I can fucking do what I please. So someone had shown me some attention that I hadn't maybe got for a long time. And I was like, all right. And it was that whole taboo thing of, you're my therapist, this shouldn't be happening. So I lost a lot of money there because I was just doing this, spending. Because the whole time I was spending too, I wasn't letting the intrusive thoughts in. And it was kind of, it was numbing everything. Do you know what I mean? That's where alcohol came into. It was numbing everything. This isn't something, it's not new, is it? We've heard this plenty of times before. But so fast forward now, I get discharged from Headley Court in the April 2018. I'm living in a house, to three-bedroom house in Amesbury, rented. My ex-wife was in the house that we had together. She still is in the house that we had together with whenever my kids stay with her over every other weekend, they go, they're in that same house still. So get to September 2018 and the army now let me go. So I am now fully just on my own. I had a girlfriend at the time. I didn't treat her very well. You know, she had her own problems. She made more problems for me, but ultimately I wasn't a very nice person. I will hold my hands up. I wasn't a nice person, not all the time. But I was just swimming in shit and I couldn't really see a way out. It got to the point where, when I'd split with my wife, I gave her half of everything. I left her the house. I left her everything in the house. I walked away with my army kit and a fucking car and some money in my pocket. I think about 60 grand, something like that. And that 60 grand lasted me about a year. But because I had had that money, my credit was quite good. So I got more money and I kept just burning it at both ends. Next thing I know, I'm out of the army. I hate myself. I don't want to be here. I need a way out. I'm 45 grand in debt. I can't pay my rent. I'm about to lose the house. There's only one thing left to do, and that's just to fucking end it. So I tried. Alcohol and some drugs, prescription drugs. I don't know how many it was. It was enough to knock me out with some vodka. I woke up covered in my own sick on the kitchen floor. So obviously I'd passed out, and fortunately passed out on my front or my side, whatever. So I didn't choke. And that was the wake-up call I think I needed to try and pull my shit together. So I went upstairs, got in the fucking shower, sat on the floor in the shower for about 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours, pulled my fucking eyes out, clean myself up, give my head a wobble, put my leg on, and then started to try and turn things around. I phoned Safa, told him what the crack was. They helped me out. They advised that I get like an IVA bankruptcy thing to help with the debt that I had got, but I still didn't have anywhere to live. So at this point I had to go back to my mum and say, like, can I fucking come home? And dude, I must have been, oh man, 32 or something. Wait, 31.
So fair to say that was your absolute rock bottom there.
Oh, it gets worse. There's another bit. Yeah. That was what I thought was my rock bottom completely. I went back to my mum's, and at this point as well, and I had the accident where I'd fucking lost these two fingers. So long story short, I was hopping through a kitchen with a brew. I slipped on the kitchen floor. I dropped the brew and I put my hand out to try and stop myself. Yeah. Landed straight at the cup. Smash. Cut these two fingers fucking clean off. They're hanging on by the skin at the back. Severed the nerves, the arteries, everything. Had to get then rushed to hospital in Cornwall, where I was at the time. They did like this botched job, and then Miss Crick come in, saved the day. Four surgeries later, I've got like 80% use of this hand. So it's all right. Yeah. It hurts a bit, but it's fine.
We touched on a little bit there. So at the same time, I'd come out of the army as you. To be honest, we didn't know each other, did we? We didn't know each other existed.
Mm-hmm.
And small world, you know, army, not an army. There's not a lot of people in it.
Yeah.
So I'd also settled in Andover at the same time, hadn't I? And I'd gone through, I'd done my recovery events, and I'd opened up a gym. And that's where we met, wasn't it?
It was.
You know, it's through Help for Heroes.
Yep.
Obviously, you're an absolute traitor because you went to the leisure centre and you didn't come straight to me.
As a PT.
And I was doing my thing there. And I remember John Carpenter from Help for Heroes.
Yeah.
Reaching out, being like, oh, there's this veteran amputee. He's going, I was like, fuck him. He's mugged. Why is he going to leisure centre? Why isn't he here? So I think that's about when we met, wasn't it? You know, John was like, look, you're not in a good place. You know, all this shit's going on in your life. Why don't you go and see Better Combat Fuel? You know, it's like a little veteran's home. We had a really, really nice, neat.
That was at Base Point, right?
Base Point in Andover, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic little gym, didn't we?
And it was brilliant, Matt, mate. And I remember we touched it, didn't we, when I turned up this morning, touching it briefly. And I was like, that could be the difference for people like me, somewhere to go and just offload. Because the whole time I'm trying to help someone else, it's helping me.
Yeah.
Too much time in your own head is a fucking dangerous place to be.
Yep.
So yeah, mate, honestly, like without having come in on that day, I don't know where I would be. Honestly. And
shout out to Fraser, who's doing all of the camera stuff behind
here. Big time.
He come there, you know, we had a really nice hub. Not just me there, like, you know, the community that we had was amazing, wasn't it? There was around 50-odd veterans that came there, you know, didn't charge anybody enough. but that's never what it was about. But, you know, it was a wicked, wicked place, wasn't it?
Yeah, mate, it was mint. And to see where it all is now is pretty fucking wild.
Yeah, sat here on my knockoff Chesterfield sofas.
Hey, they're not knockoff, these are legit. They're quite cool, aren't they? These are real, yeah.
They are real.
Yeah.
And they're not robbed from the army either.
No.
You know. But so things still kept getting worse for you, didn't they?
Yeah.
You know, so your hand had happened.
The hand had happened. So I'm recovering from surgeries with that. Can't really use it properly. It's in a big fucking brace thing. So to try and put my prosthetic on was pretty gnarly as well. All the while, I'm a piece of shit now living back at my mum's house. But shit went sideways pretty fucking fast to be in that position. And you can go one of two ways, like really feel sorry for yourself or try and pick yourself up and go again. So I was doing that. I was trying. And I remember whenever I had my kids at the time, and I had them as much as I could, but obviously I had a bedroom at my mum's house when my stepdad was still there. So it was difficult. But we used to have to kind of shut ourselves away, and my childhood was okay, but my relationship with my stepdad is very different to my sister's relationship with my stepdad. So I didn't feel comfortable there. But I remember stood in the kitchen, and he had had a few beers at this point, and he said to me that he doesn't like my kids. They're not welcome. They're fucking rude and they're ignorant. And I was like,
bro,
that was the wrong thing to say to me in the mindset I'm in right now. So I fucking flipped, and my mum stepped in and obviously calmed the situation or whatever else. But it was evident then that I was not welcome and nor were my kids. So I left, but I had nowhere to go. So I went to Tedworth House, which was at the time a Help for Heroes recovery centre. And I remember meeting with, it was either Blesma or Safa, or maybe both, explaining the situation. And they said, we can give you 5 days here at the house in the accommodation with my kids. So I got 5 days in the family room there with my two kids. And they said, but that's it. You've got to find somewhere. And I was like, I don't have any fucking money. I literally am in debt. I don't have anywhere. Like, I can't go anywhere. Said, so you've got to go and declare yourself homeless at the council offices. And I was like, this is a fucking whole new low. Okay, strapping. So I remember walking into the council offices, and I'm not one for stereotypes and stuff, but, you know, with the job centre and stuff that's there, there are, you now are mixing with a particular type of people that you are, you feel you're a million miles away from. I've served my country. I've fucking worked hard. I've put myself second to everything else. I don't particularly want to fucking be here. And I had to say those words. I've been told to come in here and declare myself homeless. And as I said those words, I was like, this is fucked. And they let me do that, as in my family, let me do that. I would never let my kids do that, ever. But it's all right. So they said, we'll help, but we can't help you right now. Long story, here's a travel lodge for 6 weeks with two double beds so your children can stay with you. I was like, sound. So I lived in a fucking travel lodge for 6 weeks. There was no restaurant on site. I had a mini Coca-Cola fridge under the counter and a PlayStation 4. And that was it. So for 6 weeks, I lived in there. And then eventually they came through the council and I got a one bedroom flat in Andover.
Yeah.
I got a one bedroom flat and it was horrendous. For the first like 3 days, I was on my hands and knees with bleach cleaning this thing up, man. It was honking.
I remember coming over and Ryan Rawlinson being there as well.
Yeah, man.
Coming and helping you out, coming to see you.
That's right.
That was a huge, the ice for anyway, a huge defining moment for you that was like,
yeah.
Do you know what? It can't really get any lower than this.
Correct.
And you were like, I'm going to do this to the flat. I'm going to do this. Yeah. I'm cleaning this. My kids are going to stay there and I'm never going to be. I remember you saying to me, stood in that bedroom where you'd let your kids sleep and you're like, I'll never be in this position again.
Yeah.
I remember it clear as day, man. Coming around. It wasn't even like car parking out there, was it? It was just
fuck all.
A free for all.
It was literally Grenfell Tower, mate, but in Andover. Yeah. It was
non-optimal.
No. And so it was a one bedroom flat. So Ryan helped me out, built a stud wall in the bedroom with a doorway, meaning the children had a bedroom each and I slept in the front room. COVID is happening now too. So I've managed to get myself a job as a PE teacher at a primary school. Didn't last very long because of COVID and all the rest of it. And the kid's mum was like, you need to have the fucking kids because I've been unfurloughed and I've got to go back to work. Okay. I was like, fine, they can come with me. So they were with me quite a lot anyway, where I would do breakfast, dinner after school and stuff. And then she would come pick them up for me. So it was kind of like 50-50, 60-40, whatever. But I was like, no, you're with me full time now. Come on. So for 2 years, mate, they slept in that bedroom. I had a fucking sofa bed in the front room in that flat. And then we get to 2020. My wife's going to fucking tell me off if I can't remember the year we met, but whatever year it was.
You say it really quickly, shall I?
2020. And then, I'd been on my own now for like 18 months or whatever in this flat. Just me and the kids, and kind of put myself back together in a way. I had to then be there and set an example, especially for my lad, really, like, and he needed to see how a man should be. And he needed to see how a man should treat a woman and all of that. So I put my head back on and that's when I then managed to meet Abby, who is now my wife. I was very lucky and I inherited two more daughters of hers and we've got another one together. So we now live, all of us together, full time, all five kids, seven of us, dogs, cats, all of it together in a fucking nice house.
Nice.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, the story doesn't end there because you've gone through all of this stuff and it could have been very easy to turn your back on the world and be like, this is my family. This is what I'm doing. I'm done
yeah.
helping other people, which would be fully understandable.
Yeah.
You know, you've been shit on in life. You didn't, did you?
No.
Ukraine's happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nothing to do with you, politely.
Yeah.
And
was it Afghan before that? The fall of Afghan.
A lot of Afghan stuff. Sorry, neglected that. You know, touch on them as well. Afghan, you've helped people out there, and in Ukraine, you've helped people out there.
Yeah.
Please do elaborate on those things.
Again, I had no plans to go and do this work for the next 3 years. That wasn't my plan. It kind of happened, but essentially, Finn. There's a common denominator, and it's Finn. He got hold of me and said, so I should touch this point. He's now badged, okay? And he's operational. And he gave me a call and he said, need some help with just some map recce in the north of Afghanistan. Can you help us out? And I was actually recovering from a surgery in hospital at the time. So I was absolutely off my face as well. And I said, yeah, man, what do you need? And he explained, and I did it. And then literally within 2 weeks, I had built a team on the ground in Afghanistan to enable the movement of high-value targets for PGHQ, DHU, agencies of UK and the US. And people coming to me to try and help get me to help them. Sorry. So in Afghan alone, we moved 430 personnel and their families out of the Taliban's, sort of out of harm's way of the Taliban, which was fucking tricky. But again, like, I felt as though I had a calling for Afghanistan. Like, I don't really believe in coincidences. And everything happens for a reason. I've been put in that place for a reason. I should do the right thing and help. And like you say, I could have just sat there and gone, nah, I'm all right, mate. I've had enough. But I was like, somebody's telling me I need to do that. So for the next like 3.5 years, I ran an intelligence and security firm. Not too long into the Afghan campaign, Ukraine happens. So me and Ryan were doing it. We were like, dude, if we're doing that in Afghan, surely we can do the same thing in Ukraine and go and help people. And at the same time as helping people, we can do what's necessary for the UK and the US, MOD, DOD, et cetera. Gather intel, bit of recce, et cetera. So 10 days after the invasion of Ukraine, we're in country. We go. Still with my shorts on, still with my leg hanging out. And yeah, we're on the ground in Ukraine, helping move people, helping them get out of harm's way. But then also we're doing the same thing where we're gathering intelligence for the MOD to paint a bigger picture for them. Sort of, we were very much in and out of Regent's Park barracks in London, where they have representatives from every intelligence agency there is and special forces groups. We're now supplying intelligence for them. We're now supplying intelligence for the MOD and Babcock, like a big military contractor, for their ops in Poland and in Ukraine. And it's just a really wild, insane time, even to the point where we had the Taliban on FaceTime ripping us, telling us we look like terrorists because we have beards. And I was like, dude, hot kettle black. The fuck are you talking about? But it was just a wild, wild 3 years of operating in circles I could only have dreamt of. And again, it came back to fucking watch me do this. Watch me. So I had a handshake from the RAS man at Hereford, along with some stuff from the mess and my coin to say fucking welcome to the club. So that my SF coin is up on the wall with my medals and stuff. And I managed to tick the box I wanted to tick when we were in Afghan and after Afghan, but in a very different way. And I kind of crowbarred my way into that community, into that world. Very quickly I became somebody that they would turn to when they needed help, which kind of rubbed my ego, don't get me wrong.
But having your ego rubs nice, though.
Every now and then you need it, right? Yeah. But it was that thing of, I am making a difference, until I got fucked over. And then the business got pulled out from under my feet overnight, lost everything. However, everything happens for a reason.
Happily married.
We now have
beautiful
our,
children.
Correct. You know, our youngest is 2. So had I have still been operational, I would have been away. I would have been, you know, not really present, even if I was at home, just because of the nature of the work. I mean, if the special forces or, you know, CIA or any of those agencies that we were kind of giving information to call and say, jump, I've got to say how high. I can't say no. So actually, it was a bit of a blessing in that I was able to champion my wife. Go and do you. Go and do what you need to do, what you want to do, and I'll stay.
Love it.
Here, yeah. And after that had all gone sideways, the door opened for me to be a full-time golfer.
We were going to touch on that saying, like, all of this stuff's happened. And
yeah.
And then golf, a little bit like jiu-jitsu, it seems to, from my point of view anyway, it's both of them have come from nowhere. I mean, I know golf's always been a big thing, but especially within the military community, a lot of people have really started taking it up. And like, how do you swing a golf club with your leg?
I get that question a lot. And I just find a way. I think what's important to know is I didn't play golf before I was injured. So I didn't really have a feeling or an understanding of what it should be like. So kind of I was at an advantage in a way of I'm going to find a way that works for me because it's the only way I know. And I've been fortunate enough to kind of turn it into a full-time gig where I create content, I play tournaments, I have sponsorship deals with golf companies, club manufacturers and stuff. I have just lost my main sponsor, if anyone's out there. No. So I don't do it for that, really. It's more that I enjoy making content and I like having a laugh. But without golf, my head comes clean off.
So that, you found your thing to keep you on the straight and narrow.
Yeah,
and
man.
It's good that it's not alcohol or drugs.
Bit like you in jiu-jitsu, right? Correct.
Absolutely. You know, the last like year or so, I've completely calmed down. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to work.
It puts you back in your box.
I do used to work 100-hour weeks. Outwork me. but yeah, finding my thing has been jiu-jitsu. Finding your thing has been golf. And to an extent, our families. But it's...
Yeah.
A family will never be able to replace the buzz we got from the military. And those two things we have.
Yeah.
There are things, I think. Unless you're in that position, you'd never truly understand how important these things are to us.
Yeah.
Like, you love your wife to pieces, but she'll never be able to offer you the thing and the feeling that the military gave you.
Yeah.
And because they're different things, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're completely different. And that's what I think golf gives to you that jiu-jitsu gives to me.
Yeah.
I'm also absolutely awful at jiu-jitsu. I'm embarrassingly bad. I'm just big compared to like the 15-year-old kids that go there. So I just sit on them and make myself
and you
feel
win,
better.
Yeah, with your slab head. Yeah.
He's
getting called a wanker.
For Fraser, who's doing the podcast, he did turn up to a jiu-jitsu session once and he...
I heard you got filled in.
He got filled in. The deal was with him, if I beat him up in sub 3 seconds, he had to do a podcast
for us.
And
here we are,
And so now we're sat here doing a podcast,
cool,
so we know how that went.
Yeah.
Very egotistical of me now. But we met through Combat Fuel.
Yeah.
Can we touch a little bit on that? You don't need to go into like what it means to you and all of that stuff. You know, we're friends and it's, but the products, you know, I pride myself on, we make good products. Our products cannot be beaten by anyone else, you know, and this isn't Rick, the guy that, sleep 20 quid later, can you say that? You've bought our products with your own hard earned money that you've, the last 7 years, really, since we started in 2018, you've been buying our stuff.
And it's important to show, so anybody watching this that does know me will know that I have Combat Fuel stamped on my golf bag. But it's also, what you should know is, you don't pay me for that and you don't give me supplements for that. That's how much I believe in this company, is that I want you to have that space in my bag so that other people get eyes on it. And when they ask me what it is, I tell them. because, and I've been on the receiving end of this a few times, as you know, with PT and then with the intelligence stuff I was doing. People want something for nothing. When, even when they're your friends, because you now own this business, they assume, oh, I don't need to pay for those tablets. I don't need to pay for that t-shirt. You should be paying more for those things because you should be supporting your friend.
We'll pay hundreds of pounds to go and see a celebrity, but we won't like, share, comment and buy our friend's products.
So
if they're crap, don't buy them though, right?
Well, yeah, they're actually good. Fair enough. But the fact is, like, I truly believe in you. This lifestyle is not, it's bigger than a brand, I feel. To see the growth from where when me and you first met and we had these ones down here with the boot print.
I'm going to have to pick one of them up. I'll put it down. So, Fraser can, like, fill me in on that. That's when we started. This was done on paint.
Correct, yeah.
Done on paint.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was like American.
That's right. But the...
Google and absolutely just steal and stick on a tub through paint.
Didn't but the know products were did we?
Still good. You know, we still had like a cyclic dextrin, an EAA blend.
You definitely found your passion with this, and that comes through in abundance. So, yes, you can go and get a tub that size of protein online for a fraction of the price, but you're going to need to use five times the amount to get the goodness when from you what you do with one.
Like the actual protein content is. But can we run through quickly, like the products that you use from, Fuel?
So big for me on the golf course, the snacks and the food that you guys do, the protein bar cups, they live in my golf bag. They're so good to have throughout the round. Optimize is a big one for me for concentration. I need to be, you know, locked in whatever. And I find that the Optimize, if I have that throughout, that keeps me, not a buzz, but it keeps me there ready to and a clear mind. Hydrate is huge for me as well, because where I am outside, certainly in the summer, a lot of moving, I can burn like 5,000 calories in a day. That hydrate stuff is an absolute game changer for me. So yeah, it's Optimize, hydrate, all of the buttercups, quite literally all of the buttercups. And then I use various protein powders or the pancake mix to make protein pancakes, protein pancake bowls. I don't necessarily have a shake necessarily. I use your stuff for cooking so that then I can have like a week's worth of breakfasts using your proteins. So I literally shit and piss Combat Fuel.
I love that.
Quite literally.
You know, we said about stroking our egos earlier. Yeah. Stroking my ego. You're stroking my ego. I like that. We got to finish off though and touch on, you know, you've had like the highest of the highs, commanding men to war in Afghanistan, to having to basically sign on the dole and say, I'm homeless to the council, you know, and had some money, lost the money.
Yeah.
Literally drank it.
Drank it, sniffed what's it, done, gambled it.
What's a bit of advice that you could give your younger self before any of this stuff had happened? If you're, say, at school age, what's the one bit of advice you could have?
I think don't wrap your tits in. Don't fucking stop. Don't. There's always a way out. You might not like that way out, but it's the right thing to do. So for anybody that's maybe in a similar situation right now to what we've been in, what I've been in, go and speak to someone, because you're worth so much more here than when you're not. There's always a way out. It's easy for me to sit there and say it now, go and speak to someone, but it's because I didn't.
You've walked the walk though. We've both lost friends.
Yes.
To suicide.
Yes.
The world's a better place with you in it.
Correct.
100%.
Correct. You know,
the power to endure the shit and it will always get better.
Grind.
Because it has to. Right?
Yeah, it does.
And you're a living proof, you know, that's been a thing. And on that, is there any like misconceptions that you wanted to like have a look at? You know, perhaps it is, don't judge a book by its cover.
That's a really... I mean, it's a common thing to say, isn't it? But you're absolutely right. There's always more to the story. So before you throw judgment on someone or you listen to the chatter from other people, find out why they're saying it. Do you know what I mean? I pride myself on my honesty, my integrity, my loyalty. For anybody out there that piped off about me, you should have fucking known better. Come and speak to me and I'll tell you the truth.
And I hope now that they see it, they've seen this and where you are in life now, and they're nothing short of just inspired by you. No resentment, no hate.
I've got no resentment, man. I don't hold a grudge. Yeah, it's not. It might have sounded like I do hold a grudge there, but you're absolutely right in that. Just go and speak to that person. Yeah. Don't be a dick.
There was something phone. Tom Holland said, Mr. Spider-Man, and it's so out of context, but kind of there, which is, if you have a problem with me, pick up the phone.
Yeah.
If you don't have my number, you don't know me well enough to have a problem with me.
Well said, yeah.
So
well said. That's absolutely true, yeah.
Yeah.
That is bang in context, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Don't follow the sheep.
Rick, where can we find you? Where can people come and support you, chat to you, find you on socials? You've got a YouTube channel as well.
I do, yeah. So it's just Rick Webb Golf on everything. Across the board, Rick Webb Golf. Predominantly Instagram and YouTube.
Just look for like a guy with a tiny head.
Tiny head, one leg, you'll probably find me.
I love it. Yeah. Awesome stuff, man. That's powerful.
Thank you very much for
being here. Taking time out of your day playing golf.
Take
those free
stuff,
I'm talking
about.
Thank you.
Thanks.